Atheist Nomads, episode 431, The Rise of Christianity in Africa.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and it's just going to be me today. I did take to heart the feedback a while ago on Apple Podcasts about when it's just me covering the news alone, being hard to keep track of when I've moved on. So I went ahead and loaded up the second side of the sound pad with some of the default stuff that came with my mixer. So be looking forward to that after dusting off the degree. Continuing on with the rise of modern crazy Christianity in Africa, we still need more of the narrowing in the picture. And when you look at the history of Christianity in Africa, we did the overall religion in Africa, like big view, do a little kind of recovering of some of that from a different angle before we move on into what the modern landscape looks like and just try and go into more detail on it. So, there were Christians on the continent of Africa by the middle of the first century CE. By the end of the second century, they made it as far as Carthage, and by the 4th century, the Aksumite Empire in modern Eritrea and Ethiopia adopted Christianity as the official religion, which they were one of the first countries in the world to do that. Then the Nubian kingdoms of Nubatia, Maguria, and Alodia also adopted Christianity a few centuries after that, and most of that was tied to Coptic Christianity. By that point, with the Chalcedonian Schism, there was a split of the church in Egypt and across Africa, with most of the Egyptian Christians going the Coptic route and some sticking with the Greek Orthodox. The Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church and Eritrean Orthodox Tewahedo Church also followed suit on the Coptic path. The Eastern North African Christians were more aligned with Rome than Constantinople and would be considered Roman Catholic by modern standards. And there were even some popes in the early days who were Africans, Berbers to be precise. Then the Muslim conquest happened, and by the end of the first millennium of the Common Era, the vast majority of all Christian populations in northern Africa had converted to Islam, and the only Christian kingdom left was Ethiopia. By the 1600s, there were only a few communities left outside of Ethiopia and Egypt, and Christians were a minority in Egypt. And by the 1800s, there were basically no Christians left outside of Ethiopia and Egypt. But that's just looking at northern and kind of northeastern Africa. When you look at the rest, there wasn't any until 1492. Well, at least the era that started with 1492. In the Western world, we know that mostly as when Columbus sailed the ocean blue and found the West Indies, which started the Spanish colonization of modern-day Latin America. What had happened that year that was as important, if not more important, was Spain had finally finished the Reconquista. Spain and Portugal had reconquered the Iberian Peninsula and gotten rid of the Moors, who were Muslims of a mix of Arab and Berber ancestry, ruling over, at their height, most of the Iberian Peninsula. Once they were done with the Reconquista, they started colonizing everywhere. The earliest European colonies were from Spain and Portugal. They actually conquered Latin America because of smallpox and other diseases the native inhabitants did not have any immunity to, so they were able to actually conquer all of that pretty easily. They weren't able to conquer Africa because of the diseases there, namely malaria, that would kill them if they tried to go too deep into Africa. So these colonies were basically just trading posts scattered all the way around the coasts of Africa, India, Southeast Asia, and China, where they had these trading posts, and in And in Western Africa, those trading posts were also heavily used for the export of slaves for the plantations in the Americas. These trading posts, being founded by and run by Catholic kingdoms, gave access to Africa to the Jesuit order. So then Jesuit missionaries started their work trying to convert Africans, sub-Saharan Africans, to Christianity, and Ethiopian Christians to a more Catholic kind of Christianity. Despite their start as early as 1548, the Jesuits didn't have a whole lot of success, and that is despite baptizing Monomotapa, who was king of the Shona people in modern-day Zimbabwe. And they had their best luck in Mozambique and Angola, which were the Portuguese colonies in Africa. So with the scramble for Africa in the 1880s and 1890s, they brought with them their state churches. So England, Britain brought the Church of England. Germany brought a mix of Lutheranism and Catholicism. Belgium would have also brought a mix of Reformed Christianity and Reformed Church and Catholicism. And Portugal, of course, would have brought Catholicism. It's estimated that by 1900, there were 9 million Christians in Africa. Now the number is somewhere between 380 million and 525 million. Which is a huge amount of growth. Obviously, not all of those Christians fit into one of the state churches of the colonizers, but a fair number do. There are 158 million Roman Catholics in Africa, which is a huge rise from the 2 million there were in 1900. And for comparison on that 380 and 526 million number, there are a total of about 800 million people in Africa. So Christianity is sitting somewhere at around 62% of the continent. Again, that depends on how you count it and whose numbers you're going with, and who you count as a Christian. But it's reasonable to assume that anywhere from half to two-thirds of Africans are Christian, and that's a lot of people. So depending on how you count how many Christians there are in Africa, there's anywhere between 400 and 500 million, meaning that out of the 800 million total people in Africa, somewhere between 49 and 60% are Christian. The 49% number is probably more accurate. That one comes with Muslims being 42% of Africa's total population. And depending on which number you count, one of the highest claims that there are 631 million Christians in Africa, which would be way more than 49%. That would put them as having the... That put Africa as having more Christians than any other continent. If we go with a more conservative 49% of the continent's population, thus roughly 400 million Christians, then Africa is behind South America and Europe. With the rapid growth in a lot of African countries, those numbers are quickly rising. So when we look at what denominations are present in Africa, it's not just the churches of the colonizers. There are also others, and the others are the ones that are we're going to be focusing on in the next couple episodes. But for those numbers, there's about 160 million Catholics, Roman Catholics. There's about 49 million Oriental Orthodox Christians in Africa. Those are specifically the Ethiopian, Coptic, and Eritrean churches. There's about 3 million Eastern Orthodox Christians in Africa. Those are the Greek Orthodox in Egypt. When you look at sub-Saharan Africa, it's mostly Protestants, with the higher numbers from the higher estimates, as many as 409 million Protestants, with Protestants being estimated to be 35.9% of the whole population of the continent, with the highest numbers being in Nigeria, with 60 million, or 37.7% of the population, Kenya, with 48 million, or 84% of the population, and South Africa with 24 million, or 47.7% of the population. 45.5 million, so about 10% of the total Protestants in Africa, are from Anglican churches inherited from the Church of England from the colonial days. 24 million Lutherans, which also would have been inherited from the German, Dutch, and some of the Belgian churches from the colonial days. The Reformed Church, Calvinism, which would have also been inherited from the colonial days from the British with the Presbyterians and the Dutch and some Dutch and Belgian churches. For the non-colonial ones, which again are the most interesting, you've got Baptists at 14.4 million and the most interesting, Pentecostalism with 202.9 million, more than a third of Christians in Africa. The biggest churches, the biggest Pentecostal churches, are the Ethiopian Kale Haywet Church at 9 million members, the Ethiopian Full Gospel Believers Church at 4.5 million, the General Council of the Assemblies of God Nigeria at 3.6 million, the Apostolic Faith Mission of South Africa at 1.2 million, and the Association of Pentecostal Churches of Rwanda at 1 million. And if you're following along, that's only about 20 million for those denominations, meaning 90% of the Pentecostals in Africa are not part of a denomination with more than a million members. If you remember from last week when we talked about the prosperity gospel, they're Pentecostals who aren't part of denominations. There is some substantial overlap here, some very substantial overlap. There are, of course, other Christians in Africa. There are Mennonites, there's Mormons and Adventists and the like. And then there are what are identified as African-initiated churches. These are formed by Christians in Africa, not tied to any denomination, and often pulling in elements from traditional religions. And that covers about 60 million people, with the Zion Christian Church being the largest at 15 million, and a handful of others. They will be interesting to look at in their own dusting off the degree, but the Pentecostals are the ones we're going to be looking at most next time. And it's time for a break. And if you want to support the show, you can become a patron at patreon.com/atheistnomads. Or you can give us a one-time donation at paypal.me/atheistnomads. If you want to contact us, you can leave us a message via SpeakPipe using the button on the website, use the contact form on the website, or send us an email at feedback@atheistnomads.com. And if you want to get a cool Atheist Nomad shirt, mug, sticker, magnet, or a handful of other items, you can go to our store at atheistnomads.com/store. Politico got a hold of a recording of a conversation between Liberty University President Jerry Prevost and Scott Lamb, who at the time was the university's senior vice president for communications and public engagement. In this discussion, Prevost said, "Are they getting people elected? Which is one of our main goals. Are they really motivating our conservative people to really get out to vote? If they are, we ought to be seeing some changes in elected officials. And we are to some extent. All I want to do is make us more effective." This was in a discussion about the university's internal think tank, the Standing for Freedom Center, which identifies itself as existing to, quote, uphold the Christian faith and defend America's Constitution. If their focus is on Liberty University is a 501c3 tax-exempt organization, to be a 501c3 organization, you need to be a church or a non-political charitable organization. The school is a 501c3 because it is primarily focused on education and spiritual matters, thus effectively a church or otherwise a charitable organization. But if they have a internal think tank whose sole goal is to influence elections, that totally calls into question the purpose of the university and its standing as a 501c3 organization. It will be interesting to see if the IRS does open an investigation based on this. But if we're lucky, something will happen. Because if you look at it, not only is Liberty University trying to shape elections, they also seem primarily to have the objective of preparing people to be political activists. And that is not a religious purpose under U.S. law. All right, so the bumper. Now you know for sure that it's a new story. Not talking about liberty anymore, talking about something else. So that's really clear, right? And if not, the Supreme Court has taken up a... The Supreme Court took up and responded to a request for an injunction against Maine's vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. And considering that the Supreme Court seems to be trying to promote Christian privilege, and the claims in this lawsuit is that the vaccine mandate threatens the Christian privilege of some nurses who don't want a COVID vaccine, there was grounds for being concerned about how the court would rule. But the vote was 6-3 against granting the injunction. In other words, they voted 6-3 saying, you're not going to win. So that is a wonderful, awesome win. This means that healthcare workers in Maine will have to get the COVID vaccine or find a new line of work or move to a different state. And the Supreme Court has softly upheld that at this point. And since we talked about the case in much more detail last time, let's move on. Wait, is that a different one? Oh, yeah. I filled up the soundboard. Now, if we're lucky, the way the Supreme Court ruled, or they didn't rule on the merits, the Supreme Court's not granting an injunction in the main case will hopefully mean they won't in this next one, where 19 states are suing the Biden administration over Executive Order 14042, which requires federal contractors and their employees to get the coronavirus vaccine. The way that is worded apparently includes Idaho's universities, which is why Idaho is joining in the lawsuit, since Idaho's universities have $89 million in federal contracts, and presumably all public universities and probably a lot of private universities also have millions of dollars in federal contracts. And a lot of healthcare organizations, well, most, have millions of dollars in government contracts. And the list goes on and on and on. There's a lot of organizations that this applies to. And so a bunch of states are suing, and specifically in three separate lawsuits: Alaska, Arkansas, Iowa, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming have all signed on to a lawsuit in district court in Missouri. Georgia, Alabama, Idaho, Kansas, South Carolina, Utah, and West Virginia have all joined together in a lawsuit in Georgia. And Texas has filed their own. Now, of course, when you look at those groupings and where they sued, Missouri, Georgia, and Texas, they are hoping to get very conservative judges in very conservative circuits. And by spreading it out like that, if two of the circuits disagree, then it increases the chances that the Supreme Court will take it up. And if you've got your hopes up, the Supreme Court won't, or at least won't side with them based on the main ruling, I would say to not get your hopes up. The main ruling, the case in Maine, had to do with a state law that was in place prior to the pandemic that had been affirmed by voters in a referendum by an overwhelming margin, and it was an administrative rule updating the list of vaccines included in the mandate. So the law in question had nothing to do with the pandemic or COVID. This executive order is specifically just about the COVID vaccine, and it is specifically designed to try to increase how many people are getting vaccinated. And it is one of a handful of examples where President Biden has used his power to try to get people to get vaccinated because he has limited power to do that because of the separation of powers and federalism. So these states are all saying that this is federal overreach, that Biden is crossing the boundaries by forcing private companies or otherwise not federal organizations to follow his rules. It'll be interesting to see how this one pans out. Okay, that's just too much fun, having multiples of these. I've only got six buttons. It's still fun. The Pew Research Center has released a new poll that found that 55% of Americans are strong or moderate supporters of church-state separation, with 28% being strong and 27% being moderate. 18% are in a mixed category, meaning sometimes they back church-state separation positions, but sometimes don't, depending on the issue. And 14% of Americans are integrationists, meaning they favor little or no separation of church and state. And about 12% had no opinion. That is super encouraging, especially with the direction the courts have been going and the way elections have been going and the way the wall of separation has been getting actively torn down. It's easy to think, oh, it must just not be popular. Well, no, it actually really is. Finding 55% of Americans being strongly or moderately supporters of anything is not particularly common. So that is super awesome. And with the 12% having no opinion, that means only 32% favor either a mixed or integrationist position. And 55 to 38 is a pretty strong showing on the side of church-state separation. 54% agree that the federal government should enforce separation of church and state. Only 19% said the government should stop. 67% said the Constitution is written by humans and does not reflect God's vision. That's more than two-thirds. 69% said the federal government should never declare any religion as the official religion of the United States. Only 13% backed the federal government advocating Christian values. That being said, 63% did back the idea of the government promoting values shared by people of many faiths. Only 5% believed that God favors the U.S. over other countries. And 70% said God does not favor any one country over others. When you get into the details on church-state separation, you do see some weaker positions, with 39% saying that cities and towns should be able to display religious symbols on public property, 30% backing public school teachers leading students in Christian prayers, and the poll did break down the respondents by religious, racial, and political categories. They found church-state separation support was high among all of the groups, but weakest among white evangelicals and Republicans. They also found that men are more likely to support church-state separation and than women are, and women are more likely to be in the no-opinion category. More educated people, well, college graduates tend to be more supportive of church-state separation, and the younger somebody is, the more likely they are to consistently favor church-state separation. They found the support for church-state separation the lowest in the South over other parts of the country, but even there, less than 20% consistently express a desire for the integration of church and state. So that is still encouraging. Mark Robinson is the Republican Lieutenant Governor of North Carolina, and he's now said that he's 95% sure that he'll run for governor in 2024. And he's already Lieutenant Governor, so he's got a shot. And remember, this is the guy who thinks that being trans or gay is filth and that the trans movement is demonic and full of the Antichrist spirit. Well, he spoke at a Stand Up for America rally and made it very clear that non-Christians have no place in his ideal government. And at the rally, he said,
"We give him thanks first and foremost. There are a lot of people out there that don't like to hear that. But I reiterate my statement from before. If you don't like it, nobody is holding you here. Jump on the first thing smoking and head wherever you want to head. You can leave God's country and we will not miss you. Tell our enemies on the other side of the aisle that would drag this nation down into a socialist hellhole, that you will only do it as you run past me, laying on the ground, choking on my own blood, because I will not give up this nation to you. It is not yours. You did not build it. You did not defend it. And you will not own it. We will. The Christian patriots of this nation will own this nation and rule this nation and help freedom survive for future generations.
So in other words, if you're not part of the 14% of Americans that are integrationists, then get on a train and get out of here. Well, okay, if you get on a train to leave the U.S., your options are Mexico and Canada. And I'm not sure what the current rules are for Americans going into Mexico, but I know to go to Canada, you need to be vaccinated. And there is high correlation between believing in church-state separation and vaccination. So that's technically possible, but Canada doesn't want us. And they keep making it harder and harder for Americans to move there because they don't want us. And I can't say that I blame them. So, yeah, if he thinks that, like, if anybody seriously thought that all the liberals in America need to leave, well, all the liberals and moderates in America need to leave, good luck finding countries that are going to take 2/3 of the population, you know, more than 200 million people. Yeah, good luck. And I really hope he loses. David Trent operates the Net for Truth BitChute channel, which, if you aren't familiar with what BitChute is, it's one of the open source alternatives to YouTube that has been taken over by crazies. Had great promise, but when you have a platform designed to not have centralized moderation and promote free speech, then when the platforms with large audiences kick them off of them, that's where they're all going to go. And so, along with most of the rest of the QAnon conspiracy nuts, that's where he's gone. He's got 2,100,000 followers there. He's got a GoFundMe page for Christian ministry and veteran advocacy that is loaded with QAnon rhetoric, and a bunch of social media pages. He had a YouTube channel with thousands of followers until, you know, YouTube got rid of QAnon conspiracy theory channels, and they mostly went to BitChute. Well, Right Wing Watch did a little digging into this guy. In his videos, he's called for Democratic politicians to be taken out at gunpoint. He has repeated the claims that Hillary Clinton and Bill Barr should be convicted of treason and sentenced to hang. His videos have QAnon slogans and the symbol of the Three Percenters, which is a paramilitary extremist group. In a September 9 video, he complained about Joe Biden requiring federal government employees be vaccinated, saying, quote, "Why this country hasn't risen up and hung these bastards by now is beyond me. These treasonous rat bastards need to be taken out of Washington, D.C. I say get all the children out and nuke it for something. Get all the children out with the QAnon conspiracy theory that Democrats and Hollywood are running a global cabal of pedophiles." And the title of the video accused Biden of being a chomo, which is prison slang for a child molester. Right Wing Watch got tipped off by Gabe Hoffman, owner and producer of the documentary An Open Secret, that David Trent is actually David Todisacheni. And they were able to validate that comparing the social media pages and details on David Trent and David Todisacheni, and confirmed they like the same sports teams, have all the same hobbies, same first name, same last initial, seem to like all the exact same things, and it definitely backed up the idea it's the same guy. Well, Todisacheni is a convicted sex offender and a level 3 threat according to the New York Sex Offender Registry, meaning that he is a high risk of repeat offense and a threat to public safety. He is categorized as a sexually violent offender and was convicted in 1999 of raping an 8-year-old boy. So the guy going around claiming that Democrats and Hollywood is filled with child molesters is one himself. QAnon supporters became convinced that John F. Kennedy Jr. was going to show up at an event in downtown Dallas, specifically near the grassy knoll where his father was assassinated, to announce that he was going to be Donald Trump's running mate in 2024. The crazy they got sold was that JFK Jr.'s death in 1999 was a fake, and he's been in hiding ever since, and has finally decided it's time to reveal that he's actually alive and that he's ready to take up the family mantle in politics with Donald Trump. Most of the people who showed up for this event were wearing pro-Trump t-shirts, and some were even in campaign-style t-shirts with Trump / JFKJ on them. And of course, John F. Kennedy Jr. didn't show up, because people who died 22 years ago can't. And how crazy of a conspiracy theory do you have that stuff like this gets believed? It's absolutely mind-boggling. Like, this is downright hilarious that they did this, but, like, they showed up waiting for somebody who's been dead for 22 years to give a speech, and he never showed, because he's dead and has been for a long time. The simplest way to debunk almost any conspiracy theory is how many people would have to be in on it to keep it secret. And the bigger the conspiracy, the less likely it's going to keep secret. Like, the main premise of the QAnon conspiracy theory is a global cabal of child molesters. The number of people that would have to be in on it and agreeing to keep it secret, it only takes one to blow the cover. And we know what a global cabal of sex of child molesters looks like. It's the Catholic Church. And it's never been secret that Catholic priests rape kids. That's something that's always been known. So it's not like something like that can actually... But for it to even go as far as JFK Jr., he was damn near American royalty. His picture was on magazines all the time. He tried, largely unsuccessfully, to have some semblance of privacy in his life. And when his plane crashed, there was a huge search and lots of people looking for him and his wife and his sister. And so if he just disappeared, all three of them would have had to be in on it. Plus, wherever he landed the plane and everybody they came into contact with, and they'd have to all be keeping it up for 22 years? No, that is absolute insanity. In India, they are celebrating Diwali right now. People across India, Southeast Asia, and people of Indian and South and Southeast Asian descent around the world are celebrating Diwali right now, which is the festival that marks the birth of the Hindu goddess Lakshmi and the start of the new year in the Hindu calendar. And this year, on November 4, so, you know, the day of release, so it'll have already happened by the time you hear this, they will be lighting up lights across Ayodhya, a city in northern India that is, according to the legends, the birthplace of the god Rama. This has traditionally been having a big celebration and lighting earthen lamps in Ayodhya has been a tradition for many years, following with the legend. And because it is believed that in that city, that the people welcomed Rama on his return to his kingdom with his consort Sita and brother Lakshman after they defeated the demon king Ravana. So Prime Minister Narendra Modi is planning a elaborate celebration this year with 10,000 earthen lamps being lit. And to many in South Asia, this is as political as it is religious, with Modi's long plan of Hindu nationalism and Hindu unity. Part of this plan, a key part of this plan, is the construction of a temple to Rama in Ayodhya, where Hindu nationalists tore down a 16th century mosque in 1992, who had claimed that the Mughal ruler Babur built that mosque on the birthplace of Rama. So in 2019, India's Supreme Court allowed the construction to start, and Modi is working on developing the city into a place for Hindus to pilgrimage to become a major site for pilgrimage. So he's working steadily to turn it into a modern city, not a small town. One of the construction projects is an 825-foot tall statue of Rama, and some are also concerned about the loss of diversity in Hinduism and other religions in South Asia. This story is from a 2,500-year-old Sanskrit epic, Ramayana, and there are hundreds of versions of the story. Some have Rama as the divine hero with Sita as the virtuous consort. There's a particular version of it in a 16th century poem that is the preferred one of the current Indian government, and it projects the values of, and it exemplifies Rama and Sita as the perfect Hindus with the perfect family. Other versions have Sita being seduced by Ravana. One central Indian ethnic group has their version of the story with Ravana, the demon king, seducing Sita. There's a different story that has Sita going to war and slaying Ravana after Rama failed to defeat him. And it, for yet another ethnic group, it's Rama's brother, Lakshman, who's the hero of the story. And there are yet more different stories across Tibet, Thailand, Burma, Laos, Cambodia, Malaysia, Java, and Indonesia. One Thai version has Rama not as the supreme lord, but subordinate to Shiva. And even just in the old Sanskrit texts, there are more than 25 different versions of the story. And Diwali is also celebrated by Sikhs for the release of Guru Hargobind, who was imprisoned by the Mughal Empire. And Jains celebrate Lakshmi, the Hindu goddess of prosperity, on Diwali with the light of earthen lamps. And with all of those different versions of the story, as it always turns out, whoever has the most money and power can control the story. And Modi is trying to use that to create a very specific version of the story to dominate. Just like how in America, a single version of the Santa story began to dominate once some money got put behind creating a solid one. A Turkish Muslim televangelist, and yes, apparently Islam has their own televangelists. He got a question from a viewer who called in saying that he couldn't stop masturbating, even though he was married, and even during Umrah. So in response, Mujahid Jihad Khan, reminded him that masturbation is forbidden in Islam and said, quote, "One hadith states that those who have sexual intercourse with their hands will find their hands pregnant in the afterlife, complaining against them to God over its rights," end quote. He also said, quote, "If our viewer was single, I would recommend he marry, but what can I say now?" end quote. So if you masturbate, the punishment is your hands being pregnant in the afterlife. So every man in the afterlife is going to have pregnant hands? It kind of sounds like if you do it once, your hands are going to be pregnant. So every single man. And in a heartwarming story, a group of Sikh men were walking through Golden Ears Provincial Park in Vancouver, British Columbia, and they saw two men below stuck on a rock while the river was threatening their safety. They called for help, but didn't know if rescuers would even come because of the poor cell reception. So they took off their turbans, rigged up a rope ladder, and pulled the two men to safety. Kuljinder Singh said in response, "We didn't have any other equipment to save them. We only had our turbans to save them. In my Sikh culture, the turban is for that, to help save the life of people who need the help," end quote. Generally, in the Sikh religion, the turban should be on at all times when in public and never removed. And these men did the right thing. They had something they could use to save a life, and they did it. And feedback. We got another message from Keith, our listener in Zambia. And by the stats, quite possibly our only listener in Zambia. He wrote, quote, "Hi, Keith again. Great work with distilling the very complex social political identities and influences that continue to operate in Africa. It's a miracle how you managed to squeeze all of that into the last episode." This is now two episodes ago. "I cannot wait for you to get into the juicy details on the interplay between religion, politics, and poverty in Africa. Great title for the episode, by the way. As you might be aware, the Berlin Conference in 1884, where European powers literally sat down to divide Africa among themselves, not a single African was present at the conference. Please excuse my impatience. I am itching to hear your take on Western religion pioneers into Africa, how that has since morphed into firebrand, miracle-working, Bible-thumping Christianity, and everything in between. As always, great job. Lauren, your quips are very witty. Keep it up." End quote. The scrambling of Africa was absolutely a nod to the scramble for Africa. And it was a couple of iterations of what had started with the scramble for Africa. I finally got it to the scrambling of and was like, oh, that is good. Oh no, that's almost too good. Oh boy. And it was hard to... And as I was preparing, I was trying really hard not to overgeneralize and to recognize and respect the broad diversity that exists within Africa. But as I was preparing, it became very clear that while there is a very broad diversity of peoples in Africa, the horrific scarring and damage from the colonial period is not particularly diverse, and that its effects can be generalized because they were pretty equally egregious. And the effects of destabilizing a continent, well, when you destabilize a continent intentionally, there are some generalized statements that can be made about that instability. And I really appreciate that. I appreciate your message saying that I handled that well. I really do. And from Christener Blasphemer via Facebook Podcasts, quote, "It's so scary that people can be told such a bunch of bullshit and they literally buy it. Maybe it's survival of the mentally fittest, lol. If it didn't profit such evil assholes, I'd have no problem letting dumb asses give away money, but it's feeding the beast, and there should be some laws against such blatant lies and abuse of power. Because power over the afterlife is the greatest power after all." End quote. And yeah, the prosperity gospel is, a number of them have gone to prison for fraud and embezzlement and racketeering and a handful of other charges of those natures, because the prosperity gospel preachers are all seriously bordering, like, they're well past the line of what's ethical, and they routinely cross the line on what is actually legal. So anyway, that's it for this week. So until next time, remember, not all those who wander are lost.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads, and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.
And I know it's really annoying, but I can play them on top of each other. That's just really annoying. I am so sorry, but also not, but I am. And we'll see if I, apparently not enough if I don't edit it out. So we'll see how that goes.